First, I want to welcome the incoming class of Department of Management Sciences, both the MBA students and the researchers. You have a journey in front of you, I hope, and you will maximize the benefit from it. There is a girls' hostel in Roorkee called Sarojini Bhavan. And at the time when I was resident there, there were approximately 50 girls. Now, this is, I was a bachelor's and I did my bachelor's in electrical telecommunication engineering. So it was a 4-year course. And in the second year, at the end of second year, it was coming to an end, and an election within Sarojini Bhavan started. It was tradition there to elect a girl to be called a Bhavan leader for the coming year. And Bhavan leader had, you know, a lot of, had some responsibilities, but also her stature, and that was true for all Bhavans, whether girls or boys. So the next, it kind of jogged my, I was a very studious person, but it sort of reminded me that next year it would be the turn of our class to take the leadership role. For some unknown reason, I decided that I'm interested in standing for the elections. This is a year before. So then the summer vacations happen, next year rolls in, few months go by, students all incoming students settle down. And I decided to ask my classmates or my batchmates, will it be a good idea to straighten out a cafeteria food situation? There was hardly any disagreement that the food was bad and the prices were too high. You know, that probably is a story of every hostel food. I had hit a universal soft spot of the girls. They suggested that they will take initiative to audit the raw supplies, the non-perishable food given to the kitchen every morning, which meant atta, dal, chawal, ghee, etc., that they would audit that. So they began by rationing the food out to the kitchen every day based on prior consumption. Then at night again, before the kitchen staff went home, they would go back and audit the leftovers. After just 2 days of doing that, they noticed lots of ghee floating in the open drainage of the kitchen. It was clear that the kitchen was not consuming as much ghee as they claimed. So they decided there was no place to hide, so they decided to toss it out, I suppose. There was a girl in my classmate, Rashmi, who was the only other girl in my class, in a class of 30, and she called them on the carpet, and she became the obvious choice for being the mess secretary for the coming year. Next, we needed to put pressure on kitchen to cook tastier food. You know, so prices were too high because they were consuming or wasting, or we thought they were stealing, which is unknown to the fullest extent. So the only way to put pressure for making tastier food was to rebel in some ways. I encouraged the girls to stop eating in the mess and call a strike. We had to, me and my friends had to go to pick up food in rickshaws and our bicycles to the town, which is probably 15 minutes by bicycle ride, to feed the reluctant participants in our strike, because we wanted more people not to eat in the mess. In a few days, this continued for a few days only, and the dean of students showed up in Sarojini Bhavan, the girls' hostel, and I was hauled from my room. He threatened to expel me, and the whole thing came to a grinding halt, and the strike had to be called off. But I managed to get elected as the Bhavan leader as a result of that in the next cycle. Dealing with your own aspirations is something we all need to come to terms with, is, in my opinion, a moral of the story. When we are not satisfied, we tend to do something about it. Not being satisfied, I think, is a good thing and essential for our personal progress. I came to the US to pursue my master's in electrical engineering. And soon after that, I started working, got married to my husband in a traditional wedding, but in the US. I would work for almost 12 years in two different telecommunication companies, and I live in what is in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is called Silicon Valley. So I had moved after my graduation from University of California to Silicon Valley. So this is where I was working. In Silicon Valley, starting your own company is a more of a possibility because it's in the air. You know, it's I compare it with being, if you go to Spain, for example, most of you haven't been there, you'll see how much art there is. People are aspiring, people on the street are aspiring to be artists because for centuries, they have really been forged the artistic talents in Europe. So in Silicon Valley, similarly, the starting your own company is talked about as if it's a trivial thing to do. Very few start companies and very few, even fewer succeed at success is less than 1% and success can be measured in different ways, but it's a very small probability as you all can very easily associate with. However, I took the leap. Ended up achieving many big and small successes because of my own initiatives. I worked very, very hard to get there. I would say that there are no shortcuts in life that my journey told me. So now, fast forward after I left my secured job and 10 years later, and I started my company, and 10 years later, our VC decided, the venture capitalists who funded us, decided it's time to go public. So I'm trying to depict the scene that went of going public. There was a, after the decision was made at the company's board level, all hands meeting was held. It involved investment bankers who were going to help us take public. They are the people who connect with the financial community. Our financial auditors, our lawyers, they were all sitting around a large conference room table. And I was there and I was being held on a pedestal. It was hard not to feel like a queen, you know, being these people who were I looked up to because I thought they were they knew how to do things, how to get things done. So they treating me with utmost, putting me on pedestal was obviously something I couldn't ignore. A few weeks later, another such meeting was held. You know, we had many meetings, but another meeting was held. And it was, in that meeting, we decided how many new shares will be issued. And I was still the majority shareholder in the company. And 30 years back, when I very quickly in my mind calculated how much my net worth is worth, it was over $100 million. I hadn't even seen $1 million, forget about $100 million. It was a high point of my entrepreneurial journey, I have to admit. I could not put my feet on the ground. From being nobody, as I thought of myself before I launched my company, I would become the envy of my coworkers of my old company. And in some ways, the whole Silicon Valley would notice me. I was not, you know, that wasn't something I had achieved ever before. However, the journey of 10 years that I spent in making a go of the company and leading it through growth pains seemed worthwhile. It wasn't an easy journey. It was difficult, but now it seemed like, oh yes, it is worthwhile. And you never know that. So the thing is to continue to pursue what your aspirations say is how I would put it. During these 10 years, there were lots of learning. Obviously, one has to procure VC funding. Nowadays, it's much easier than it was in those days.
How do entrepreneurs measure the dimensions of the window of opportunity?
Window of opportunity is not an exact science, but it is important to start early. And all as human beings, we can do is work as fast as we can and as thoughtfully as we can. And we have one brain, and I think we underestimate ourselves. We are capable of doing a lot. So I would say that take strength from within and move as fast as you can and as well as your brain allows you to.
Glass ceilings do exist, be it any part of the world. What are your views on this?
I think the world is becoming shrunken. The learnings can be done from other countries, and we can pursue our aspirations everywhere. I'm not sure if I totally understood your question. I mean, if I don't end up answering it, please let me know. So I think as I look at it, there are learnings to be sitting in the US. I feel that we have lots to learn from other countries, and we should not shy away from there. There are styles, there are cultures which are very powerful, which help enhance our learning. So I try to be more global in my thinking. And fortunately, especially with the lockdown of COVID, you have a lot of opportunity to hear what other people are saying, listen to it. Internet is such a valuable tool. And I think silo thinking doesn't quite get you where you want to be.
The question is more about in that context. Do you agree with that? Because you have had such an experience of working in powerful positions in the US. So do you relate to that?
Of course, the world is not as uniform and giving opportunities to women as to men, just because they are more familiar, it's more tradition and all that. But the way I ended up looking at it, my journey as an entrepreneur was tough enough that I could not even fathom to give myself any excuses that, oh, I will not succeed because I am a woman, I cannot succeed because I'm an immigrant, I cannot succeed because I have an accent. You know, in an American environment in those days, it was not common. So I think if one has the passion to do it, one becomes a bit desensitized to the fact that you do have barriers. I'm not saying that we don't have barriers, but you can't change the world. But you know, now in my life, I do try to be a proponent of women. After I have retired from my Digital Inc. Days, so I think there is a way and style to do it. I would certainly hope that the world becomes better and better. It already is, but still there are glass ceilings. Yes.
What would be your recommendation for us to building the habit of making learning as part of our lives and lightening the cognitive burden now?
I give a lot of importance to, we read a lot. We read on social media. We express on social media. We have our, you know, we read books and we hear podcasts. I do. And all of these things are become an activity rather than learning. And I think I find that it is important to sometimes sit back and say how I'm spending my time, what am I retaining out of these things? You know, just hearing an idea and it goes through your mind and it never stops, doesn't do any good to us. And social media is a place where it happens more because there are so many views and people are so passionate about their views, and the more they are different is how they get touted, as we know, on social media. So I think as the only thing we can control is think about retention of the idea. Next day, if we get up and find that idea didn't make sense, then it did not make sense. And I would say that is a tool to lighten the cognitive burden.
What do you think that students can do to be more employable now?
I have reflected a lot on this issue. And I think I'm not as familiar how Indian companies are hiring students, but in the US, top schools carry a cliche. Those students get paid higher. But hiring from the top school is a safe hire, whether a person is as capable or not. And people, because some school has given, some brand name school has given them a stamp of approval. So the hiring company or hiring manager has to do less of a job. So there are two things I would do. I would give a little less credence just because somebody is from a good school. That doesn't mean that they are not as good, but you count it down. There is another thought that I have experienced, which is if a person is very, presents himself or herself well, it's good in presentation, has a good physical demeanor, those people become naturally impressive. And out of school, when you have very little experience, you want to find out what is the internal guts of the person. How does the person make decisions? How does the person think? So that is another thing to discount a little bit. Not entirely. We are all humans. We all like handsome and beautiful people. So I'm not saying that we discount, but these are the soft things that I have learned. Hiring is a tough job, and you have to take ownership of hiring. Your first job you will get because of where you are coming from, and IIT Roorkee would be a great stamp of approval. So, and it was hard to get into. So these are not easy places to get into. So you already have proven that you are more capable than many other students are. I don't know if it fully answers what you asked, but.
What, according to you, are the better alternatives to capitalism, ma'am, going forward in the future?
I think capitalism is essential for the well-being of the people, not just the capitalists, but the well-being of the people. If it can be, and it cannot survive with classification of people, it has to also focus on uplifting the underserved, the people from underserved communities. Because if there is too much of a class distinction, there is going to be a riot. Those people are not going to be satisfied in a democratic setup. So democracy and capitalism together, I think, is a powerful combination. None of them alone are perfect, and they need to be tweaked in thinking. We need to give freedom to the to making money is not bad. Making money is good, as long as it also serves a greater purpose. If we look at the people who have made the most money in the US, the big names that you all know, what are they going to do with their money? I mean, money alone doesn't buy you anything. You know, you're not going to, it's only a report card that you made so much money, but you have to put that money back through philanthropic efforts back into the society. That is not done in a very perfect way, because Bill Gates may know how to run Microsoft, but does he really know how to solve world's problems? And those are the kind of questions that we should be asking. And that doesn't mean that his giving is a bad thing. It's a good thing that he's giving his, putting his effort and everything else. But can he make the best decisions? Maybe, maybe not.
We'd like to show you some photographs, ma'am. And we'd love it if you can mention the first thing that comes to your mind.
I got a lot of memories. I have driven on my bicycle through the gate many times. You know, we love the environment on one side of it is very different than the other side. The campus is very serene, very beautiful. It evoked the learning in me. I remember remember it very well. And we used to have Garhwali Chowkidar and his family, who used to be the gatekeepers and prevented girls from going out and boys from coming in. Yeah, the telecommunication department served me very well. Dr. Kamal used to be the head that time. And yes, we spent, of course, 3 years out of 4 in that particular building. In the EM club, I used to do photography, which I used to enjoy a lot. And we had, interestingly enough, we had a swimming pool that we used to go into. Most of the girls did not know how to swim, so we all used to swim on the side. I did know how to swim, not so well, but I did swim. But it was quite interesting that, you know, everybody used to go on swimming, but only two people could swim because they all wanted to be on the sides. We saw a few movies in the hangar. The exams used to be held in the hangar. And I was not a very big movie fan. I was quite studious person, you know. I used to put my head down and just do the work and study very hard. That is what we came to Roorkee for, and that's what I did.
What would be your, you have seen life, I believe that, right? So you are also a teacher, a great teacher. What would be your suggestion to us teachers? What is more important? Because nowadays it's being really competitive world. And sometimes, you know, we have so much of information, knowledge everywhere. But what would be the key? What would you suggest us also, you know, to impart to our students?
Well, I'm thinking as I'm formulating my answer, it's a tough question for me. I would say that encourage whichever tool we use, but to encourage creative thinking and not traditional answers. You might be already doing that. So I think creativity, originality in ideas, even if they sound not so interesting or not so, you know, perfect, imperfect original idea is better than a perfect traditional idea in my way of thinking. So I think that is, when I came here and my experience here is there is a lot of originality in thinking, and people are encouraged that even when they fail.
How can we do a risk analysis or maybe a risk assessment? Like when we start a venture in a sector which is still in its early days, like you started a firm of network hardware when internet was barely like beginning to pick up pace. So like, how can we assess the risks of that?
Well, first of all, entrepreneurship path itself is filled with risk, but there is an excitement when you're taking a risk. And when you are young, you can afford to take risk. It becomes harder and harder in life as you progress. You have family, you have children and responsibilities and expectations. So I think it is, how do you get your arms around risk? You don't want to be foolhardy. And I think we all ignore how lucky we have been in life at times. For example, could I really predict internet at the time I started the company? The answer is no. So I was lucky to be in an area where I was, which blossomed into internet, and our product fitted right into it. So what that did was it gave us more runway to make mistakes and not get, not go belly up. It allows you, permits you to make mistakes and keep moving forward. So I think there is no good answer, but analysis is a must. You have to analyze the risk and reward ratio and then move with the gut feel, because the answers are not going to come from spreadsheets.
If I ask you, what are your, two, three takeaways from life that has helped you immensely in your progress, in your growth, in, holding in your path of success, what would you say?
You have tools in colleges. We were given a lot of good knowledge and tools to build to resurrect ourselves and to prepare ourselves for the professional world. I think as we progress, we get tested on our how we project ourselves to ourselves as well as to others, which by that I mean that when you learn, I don't want to come across as lecturing, but I want to show my journey that you cannot feel too proud that you did well. You have to move to the real joy comes from I did this, what can I learn next? So my biggest peeve is learning and learning how to learn. So the constant journey of wanting to learn something and experience the joy in that and the effect of that, you will not get the joy. We are not so selfless that we would that we get emboldened by our own thoughts and processes. We do need external feedback on those. So for example, when I started writing, and I needed reinforcement. So there were a few friends who in the beginning, my writings were not as good as one would imagine, to just develop everything. When I started playing bridge, I wasn't good at playing bridge. I still don't think I am that good at bridge, although I won championships. But these are the learnings give you such highs, and it teaches you how to put yourself together. And if after every calamity, if you can put yourself back together, that takes you far ahead than just good. Well, I just want to say thank you to everybody, and thank you, Dr. Arora, for inviting me, and I enjoyed the discussion. It made me think. It made me realize what are the questions people have on their minds, and I hope I I learned something out of it, which was incredible. And to see the youthful energy of the students on the call has been my pleasure to see. And I want to wish all of you the best of luck.
Thank you.